Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza, and I just spent the last week reconnecting with my European brothers and sisters in Portugal and Spain. You'd think I'd relished the chance to do so, but actually I spent most of my time frustrated with Spanish waiters as they spoke to me in English and I insisted in responding to them in Spanish, resulting in neither of us speaking our native languages. But all I wanted to do was to prove that I wasn't like those other Brits who speak just loudly and slowly at them. Why didn't they understand? Anyway, dos cervezas, por favor.
Was that aimed directly at me or just indirectly? Was I just caught in the crossfire?
I think you're... Are you one of the people who just speak painfully slowly at foreign waiters?
I mean, I have to speak painfully slowly to American waiters as well, because they don't seem to understand me, so... Maybe it's not a problem at this point.
Maybe? Good heaven forbid, Jimmy. We meet sometimes to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. We've just come off a bit of a break because I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. But we're back again. I had a holiday, and we're all raring to go now. What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy?
I think we are starting off, as you mentioned, your European connections. We're starting off with the Finnish political crisis in Italy following their recent general elections. They've actually finally managed to cobble together a government out of the Five Star Movement Party and the Northern League, or League Party, I think it's just called now.
La Lega, yeah.
Yeah. And we're also going to, you know, haphazardly bolt that on to what's been happening in Spain, which Jazza is going to tell you about because I don't know it.
Yeah, the Western Mediterranean has basically decided to do all of its news in the last 2 weeks. So we're going to just go over that and hopefully explain what's actually happening with our Latin language speaking friends.
I mean, obviously English is also a Latin language. Arguably.
It's more of a bit of a bastard, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got like a sort of German base with French and Latin and a bit of Norse put on top of it.
Well, it sounds like you're describing like a lovely dinner dish there. With sort of German base.
Speaking of things that are being hastily cobbled together.
Hey!
Jazza, do you have any idea what's going on in the Brexit negotiations? At this point,
all I know is that I'm really glad that Boris Johnson never tried to become Prime Minister.
He did try. He just never succeeded to become Prime Minister.
No, he never actually officially ran.
Oh yeah, I mean that is true. But he sort of unofficially ran and then was stabbed in the back by Michael Gove.
I'm just kind of glad that he's not in. I was going to say not in the position of power. He's the fucking foreign secretary,
Boris Johnson.
Yeah. So there were whisperings last week about. There seems to be a lot of questioning around this new phrase called maximum facilitation, which basically means that it's one of the solvings of like Northern Ireland, making sure that we completely separate from the European Union in terms of like the customs union and all that kind of stuff, but then use technology, very exciting, incredibly sexy, in order to police those kinds of like border checks and all that kind of stuff while still maintaining a free and open border on the island of Ireland. It seems far-fetched, but people are worried that Theresa May is going to make some concessions to the Europeans, and so it will not necessarily be able to do this. So David Davis, who is the Brexit secretary, I am confused what he actually does, though, other than just give uninformed interviews to the BBC every now and again. There were talks of him possibly quitting because he was very unhappy with the type of Brexit that Theresa May was putting forward, that it wasn't going to be hard enough. We then, like a couple of days after these rumours first started swilling around, had a leak from BuzzFeed News where Boris Johnson was talking to a Conservative dinner and basically said that we should be more Trumpian and that the cabinet is still very split on the idea of what kind of a Brexit we want, bearing in mind that it's less than a year away when we actually leave. Theresa May still has kind of like the goal of October as being when all of the terms are kind of like decided, and then we can ease seamlessly into a transition of us not being in the European Union anymore in 2019. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Jimmy?
I feel we should save the thoughts for the actual segment.
Oh, you so tease
I'm
you.
I'm going to tease the audience in that manner. so for our third and final segment, we are actually going to be covering, probably briefly, because I feel like the other topics are going to go on for a while, this business with Lush's Let's Lush the Soap Shops Spy Cops campaign.
It's also my favourite like saying from the West Country. Oh, that's Lush, that is.
I think that was briefly slang at my school as well.
Really?
Didn't quite catch on, I don't think.
I keep on trying to make Lush happen.
I don't think Lush is going to happen, Jazza. anyway, they decided to mount an advertising campaign criticising the quote-unquote spy cops. These were the police that were embedded with, I think it was sort of Greenpeace and left-wing activists to such an extent that they actually formed relationships with some of the female activists, and in some cases I think even fathered children with them.
Oh God.
Does that sound correct?
Oh, that's dark.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know a huge amount about this, the thing. I know more about like the Lush campaign.
Right, yeah.
Blimey.
But anyway, Lush decided to mount this campaign. I'm not really sure what it has to do with selling soap.
And bath bombs, Jimmy. Don't you dare belittle their products.
I heard someone describe it as like a hipster soap shop, which seems fair, I think. But after a couple of days and a lot of politicians getting irate, and apparently some potential customers coming in and demanding that the displays be taken down in certain shops, Lush have decided to desist with the campaign for the time being. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess we're going to talk about sort of corporate activism and that sort of thing, get into the weeds of that.
Gripping.
Indeed. Should we play some music, beg people for money, and get on with the podcast?
I would like that very much.
If you like what we do at the Right Dishonourable podcast and want to contribute to the running costs and potentially buy me a new microphone at some point in the future, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. We've also just set up Audible links so that you can support the podcast by subscribing to the audiobook service. Go to audible.com/rightdishonourable or audible.co.uk/rightdishonourable and you'll see all the details you need in order to sign up. Our thanks, as usual, to Ollie McGregor, Agatha Hoder, Gemma Cumming, Matt, John O, and Emerson Spartz. Thank you very much for supporting the podcast. I'll tell you what, actually, I'll start with a provocative question.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Can't you just be normal like everybody else?
Jazza, before we started recording this podcast, you predicted that Italy might, in fact, split up, I assume, into the northern and southern regions.
No, I didn't say that at all. I just said that I thought that I was being dramatic. I can't believe that you're taking this thing I said off air and presenting it to our listeners. I said that I thought that Italy would dissolve, probably like a lump of sugar, into the Mediterranean Sea. I didn't actually think
so you
that
think
Italy
it's just going to sink into the Mediterranean
yeah, it's
Sea, then?
I meant break apart in a metaphorical sense, not literally break into two countries.
Right. And I mean, you know, breaking into two countries is also metaphorical in a sense.
I mean, also, we need to remember Italy is one of the youngest countries, at least in terms of like established European states and ones that we think about the big states. It's only about 150 years old in its current composition. It only became like a united country in, I think, the mid-1800s.
Mm. I don't know that for a European country, that's not that young as it goes. I mean, if you look at most of the Eastern Bloc, they'd be younger than that.
Sure, but like it would have been the Roman Empire in some way, shape or form, and then it was like some separate states, and then it became like Italy again. And so the idea of Italy, like, there's been an idea of Spain, of Portugal, of France. There's been, like, fragmented, but there's been, like, ideas of Germany and, like, the Nordic states and stuff. But Italy, as in terms of, like, that peninsula having its own identity and own political system, is relatively fresh. And I think that that is an important thing to bear in mind.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, those are all valid points. But in, I mean, for people who've not been following this story, a couple of months back in March, the Italians had their general election for this year. It did not produce a majority, so there was a lot of haggling over who was going to run the country. The upshot is that, as we said in the intro, the Five Star Movement and the Northern League have formed a coalition. And there's been a bit of argy-bargy as to like what the composition of the cabinet would look like, including I think some involvement from the EU. Is that right?
So essentially, what has ended up happening? It seemed very clear, because there were 630 seats in the Chamber of Deputies in the Italian Parliament. It seemed very clear that the Five Star Movement, the left-wing insurgent, kind of like populist. It's not a party, populist movement. They got 222 seats, so they're the largest party, and they kind of get to say who they make alliances with, because they needed an alliance to get over the 315 needed for a majority. So they cut out, they completely ruled out doing anything with Forza Italia, who are Berlusconi's party. Tried to do some stuff with the Democratic Party, who are like the centre-left party, but they kind of fell through. So the only real options were for them to have a coalition, have some kind of an agreement with the Liga del Norte, which is like a northern kind of like regionalist, anti-immigration, more right-wing, but also populist party. And so they tried to put together a government, and in order for there to be a functioning government, it needs to be approved by the president. So the president isn't democratically elected by the people; it's he's put in place by a selection of like the Senate and the deputies in the Italian government. And the current president is Sergio Mattarella. So Mattarella looked down the list of all of the people who were meant to be serving in cabinet positions, and looked at a particular one, this guy called Paolo Savona, who is an academic, was quite Eurosceptic, and he was being put forward as finance minister. And Mattarella, the president, said, I am going to use my presidential power, and I'm going to say that I am not going to let Savona be the finance minister, because he said some Eurosceptic things in the past, and I'm worried about what the markets are going to do. And as a defender of the constitution, I need to do this.
Specifically, the potential finance minister actually floated the idea that Italy should leave the euro, albeit in a sort of staggered, incremental sense.
So you know how pro-European I am, Jimmy. And even I think that actually he had quite a sensible roadmap. So he was like... So from what I understand, Savona's stance on Italy's relationship with the euro and the European Union was, at the point where Italy is no longer gaining... is no longer profiting from being a member of the European Union and the euro, then there needs to be a roadmap set out in order for Italy to leave, and there need to be options for Italy to be able to leave or revert to the lira or any of those kinds of things. And that, I don't think that's a very extreme stance, but that was enough for Mattarella to say that he didn't want him in the government.
I mean, I don't understand the Italian constitution very well, but In my understanding of most kind of presidential systems, where the president is kind of ceremonial and sort of has a similar role to what the Queen has in the UK, that does seem a bit of an overtly political decision to take. Do you not think?
So this is one of the problems with covering certain political systems from especially a UK and like an American perspective, is that the Italian system is so different and it's built so differently, and the constitution works in a very different way. So Mattarella's role as the president is to be a constant who they generally only serve for one term. And they will generally be an older statesman who is there to uphold the constitution and to make sure that the constitution is not is not undermined by any party that is in power. So they potentially have an awful lot of power in order to kind of protect the duration and the longevity of the Italian state and the Italian constitution. And so he does have the right to do this. This isn't like it doesn't happen very often,
like ultimate discretion? Can he do it for theoretically any reason?
I think it's like basically if it's something that is seen to counteract the Italian constitution, then that's his job to step in.
I mean, I'm sure you saw this as well, a lot of the Eurosceptic commentary on the Italian, the formation of the Italian government, did fixate on this idea that a finance minister had been blocked from assuming office, essentially because he had Eurosceptic views.
Yeah, that is essentially what happened. And I'm not in any way saying that Mattarella was perhaps right to kind of overreach in this way. I think it was an exceptional circumstance.
Well, I think the Five Star Movement and the League actually floated the idea that he should be impeached for what he did before they...
They did float the idea. Yeah. I'm not sure how realistic any of those ideas were. Like, it was talked about. But now... So, this kind of weird thing is happening in Italy where there is this kind of, like, populist alliance at the like forming the government with the Five Star and the League. They have now got a prime minister, Giuseppe Conte, who has never been in politics before. He's a lawyer. He's like a barrister, and people have been very unclear. And he's not technically from either of the parties, and it feels very unclear as to what his role was going to be. And he said that his job is now, in the same way that Mattarella's job is to uphold the constitution, it's going to be Conte's job to maintain the coalition agreement that the League and the Five Star Movement have. And so then it looks like in Italy there is going to be a huge amount of power in the individual ministries. And we kind of see that with... Di Maio, who is the leader of the Five Star Movement, he is now going to be Labour Minister, and he's going to be rolling out a huge like state benefit reform. And then there's Salvini, who is the head of the League, and he's kind of taking the driving seat when it comes to immigration, and he's already started talking to other kind of European leaders about refugee and about asylum seeker quotas, because Italy does end up having, because of its geographical proximity to like parts of Africa, it does tend to have a huge amount of footfall of asylum seekers going through its country.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, from like your outsider perspective of following this, do you see this as actually a viable government for several years, or do you think it's going to be inherently unstable and probably break up in short succession?
I feel like actually what they've put in place does make a lot of sense. Conte does. He even said that this was going to be the Third Republic of Italy in terms of like how different it was going to function, and how different his role was going to be as Prime Minister as well. He seems to be the guy there who's meant to be like holding everything together, and you do have not a massive majority, but a healthy majority with these two populist parties. And they have a common goal in that they both want to shake shit up. So the Five Star Movement want to create a welfare state, essentially. And as long as they are able to do that, and then they allow the League to be able to pass stricter immigration rules and stricter rules on asylum seekers, and also the Liga want to introduce as flat a tax as possible, as is allowed by the Italian constitution.
You mean a flat income tax?
they're going to... So that's actually not possible with the Italian constitution, but as close as they can get to a flat tax for individuals and for businesses.
Right. So does that represent a tax cut for individuals and businesses, effectively?
We don't know yet.
Okay.
But there's...
I mean, is it fair to say
basically
that
Italy
league,
is potentially league... going to look very different in the next few years?
You mean from the point of view of...
From the point of view of how its society works, how its political system works. I think that this is a really... I think that this is a really big deal for the country. And also, it's what the people voted for. This is kind of one of the problems, is that we have... people voting for populist parties. That's not really the problem, but I feel like there is this friction between now this Italian government and the European Union. The European Union, and also we need to remember the European Central Bank, who Italy have to pay a lot of debt back to. They do not like this populist government being in power. And so I will not be surprised if there is as much... done as possible to undermine a lot of the things that are going through at the moment, that will end up going through in Italy.
You mean in terms of the welfare reforms and the tax reforms?
Yeah, I think that, well, because also Italy has pays very, very low interest at the moment on a debt load that is over 100 times the country's GDP, which is...
You mean more than is more than the country's GDP rather than over 100 times?
It's over 100 times greater than the country's GDP. I think it's 130 times larger than the country's GDP.
Do you mean 130% of the country's GDP? 130 times sounds way too much.
Oh, maybe, yes. Yeah. Maybe I've written that down incorrectly.
Yeah, I think that's probably... I mean, that is like what is seen as actually a too much debt, basically, if your country's debt is more than the money it's taking on a yearly basis. So, yeah, I think it probably is 130%. I mean, how does this... I mentioned the Eurosceptic response to the Italian general elections earlier. As someone who is pro-EU and did vote Remain, how do you feel about the interactions between the sort of EU officials in Brussels and the ECB as well, which I think is based in Frankfurt, and the potential sort of Italian government?
People should be allowed to vote for who governs them.
But isn't it the case that the EU inherently places constrictions and restrictions on what it is that governments can do, which makes it difficult for people to vote for certain things?
I think that has happened if you're part of the Euro, and it's happened especially in Italy because that country has so much debt that it has to pay back to the European Central Bank. Mm-hmm. And it is possible that they can move that debt around, but it seems very, very unlikely in the current situation that they're in. And so it does mean... I mean, you saw it with Greece. You saw democracy be eroded for stability because these countries are so intertwined. And it's one of the problems with the European Union that there isn't a shared kind of like... the equivalent of a chancellor that we have in the UK, like a shared finance minister. And it was stupid that they'd have a shared currency without a shared finance minister. Like, I still think that that was a bad idea, even though I'm pro-European and I think we should stay in the European Union. Mm. But I think that this flares up and is actually a better example of the problems and the conflicts within the European Union and its future. I think this Italy is a better example of that than what's happening in the United Kingdom.
Mm. I mean, we would be able to see sort of what's going on in the UK, but we actually need to go via Spain. What is happening in Spain, roughly speaking?
Right. So, oh God, drama. So, Mariano Rajoy, who was the Prime Minister of the Partido Popular, who are the centre-right conservative, he's been Prime Minister since 2011. It's kind of by a lot of people, especially kind of like the more right-wing end of Spanish media and society. He's seen as kind of like the guy who got Spain out of the financial crisis. And if you remember, like, Spain at its worst had 50% youth unemployment. had huge amounts of unemployment that was affected terribly by the financial crisis in 2008. And he's kind of credited as taking it out of that. What ended up happening was, so there's been, since 2009, there's been an investigation about possible kickbacks received by politicians within Mariano Rajoy's party for public contracts. And Mariano Rajoy is kind of like implicated in a lot of that scandal, and he a vote of no confidence was brought against him by the PSOE, who are the socialist party who are now in power, and he lost that vote. He's the first Spanish prime minister to ever lose a vote of confidence in their congress of deputies, and so now Spain, the second party of Spain, the PSOE or the Socialist Party, they have now formed a government. The thing is, though, if we continue to have these like quiet revolutions across the world, I am okay if more of these political leaders look like Pedro Sanchez. he's a gorgeous man. He's in league with like Justin Trudeau and Emmanuel Macron. Frankly, I'm not mad if we get more of these handsome devils. That's fine. So Pedro Sanchez is now the new prime minister, only has 84 seats in the 350 seat Congress of Deputies.
The Congress of Deputies is the lower house.
In the lower house, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Spoiler alert: 84 is nowhere near half of 350. Mm. So he's formed a government with a relatively small amount of people that is very like socialist party heavy, and now has a supply and an agreement and supply,
confidence and supply.
Yes, confidence and supply agreement with the left-wing populists, Podemos, and a load of smaller regional parties, which is like a mess of a coalition. And they barely get over like the 50% needed to be able to pass legislation. The Partido Popular, Rajoy's old party, and the Ciudadanos, who are like another centre-right party, more centrist party, they are now the official opposition.
So under the confidence and supply agreement, the coalition agrees to support, you said his name was Pedro Sanchez, in sort of confidence motions and...
Pedro Sanchez.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Sanchez in motions of confidence and also in budgetary things. That's where the supply element comes in. Is that right?
Yes, that's broadly what it's going to be.
But in terms of any other legislation he wants to pass, it's going to be on an ad hoc basis, right?
Yes, exactly. Which actually, I mean, you know me, Jimmy, this is the kind of politics that I actually like. I think there should be these kinds of like coalition building things, and this should be done over consensus. Mm.
Spain, I assume, has a more proportional system of voting than we do.
They do have a much more proportional voting system than we do, yes.
Right.
That kind of takes into account regions, but also kind of has a top-up list. I think it's closer to the Scottish model than anything else.
Okay. So what are your thoughts on this kind of change of government then? Obviously, it's a far more unstable coalition than what Rajoy was running, but what are the implications?
It is. So first of all, this is a very visual government, not just because of
the hottie
Pedro's
in charge.
Beautiful, not just because of the hottie in charge and his beautiful jawline, but also he has appointed a cabinet of, it's like two-thirds women. The deputy prime minister is a woman, and I think like defence there's a female cabinet minister and blah 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 blah. Like it's a majority female cabinet, which I think is more. I think that says more about like what he wants the headlines to be than anything. I'll be sceptical and frank about that.
Mm.
Not saying that these women are not going to be like qualified for these jobs, but I think he knows what he's doing because he's a young, attractive left-wing politician that is then going to get positive, kind of like he's playing to that kind of younger left-wing base.
Right, so the comparison with Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister, is more than just skin deep in that sense.
Yes, exactly. Although I would say that actually, yes, it is very skin deep, because it's you need to govern for those people as well as have them in the positions. I love having those people in positions. You know me, Jimmy. I love a good token.
You are a diversity sap.
I am a diversity sap. I bloody love it. But that's like one interesting thing about what Sanchez has decided to end up doing.
But policy-wise, you know, aside from the diversity issue,
This is one of the problems. People are like, "You lost the election, mate, and now you're in charge."
Right.
This has been a huge pushback, and then there's also bloody Catalonia, and he's relying on some Catalan votes in order to get through legislation, and so he, I think, is probably going to have to address the Catalan question again, because Catalonia is basically declaring independence right now. Like it's saying, like, "Oh yeah, we've just rest of Spain, Catalonia here. So we're now a republic, and we're going to do like what we want. Okay, bye." Is essentially what's happening in Catalonia.
I thought all of Catalonia's separatist politicians were like arrested or, you know, had been charged with treason and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So I wasn't wrong about that.
No, they would 100% have. It's going to be very interesting how Sanchez ends up dealing with that. Some people are worried about that, but there's this idea that he lost the election and was quite a way behind the Partido Popular when they lost, and now what are you going to put through? You were talking about the stability of Italy. Mm. I think that Spain's stability. The next election is meant to be in 2020, I believe. Maybe a little bit later. Oh no, I think it's 2020. And that's just like, the chances of him being able to last until then seem slim, and the chances of him winning after that seem slimmer. Now, in 2018, what the fuck do I know?
So this is a stopgap rather than a long-term government, then?
Maybe, but I think he wants to be long-term. Bless him.
Okay, so from one chaotic administration to another, shall we talk about the going-ons of Brexit?
That was... So I'd like that segue, Jimmy, if you didn't already use it in the introduction.
But it's... I mean, it's an evergreen segue. You know, it will never stop being relevant.
Lovely. So yeah, go on. What's happening with Brexit, Jimmy?
I mean, as I intimated in the intro, I'm sort of not sure. I've kind of slightly lost the threads of what's going on. Because it seems to be the messaging being put out by the government, and also the way it's being interpreted by journalists, is just quite chaotic in and of itself. And even when there's obviously a Tory civil war effectively going on, and even when they come up with an agreement, in this case the backstop that you referenced, it's then put to Brussels, who don't appear to be that interested in what's being put forward. So at this point, I don't really know. Do you know?
So this is one of the biggest problems with Brexit, apart from all of the other shit things that are happening. By the way, thanks, Jimmy.
I'd say this is the main problem with Brexit is actually the incoherence of, like, the
plans
to leave.
What does it look like?
Yes.
That's the thing, and there are so many... I mean, there are perhaps, like, three broad options. One of them is Norway, the other one is Canada, and then the third one is a magical fairyland that's never going to exist.
So am I right in thinking the Norway option is essentially or similar to remaining in the European Economic Area?
It's basic, yeah, we remain in the economic area. We have to, basically, Norway has this option because they put, the party in power at the time wanted Norway to become a member of the European Union. And then they put it to a vote and the people said no. So then the party went to the Europe and went, "Can you just give us everything apart from actual membership? Thanks, lol, bye." And so Norway actually, I think, objectively have a really bad deal. They have to adhere to all of the same laws as the European Union. They have to kind of like... Their power is weakened. They're not able to make any of those laws because they don't have representation in Parliament or in
See, I've heard this interpretation. I think it's the kind of consensus one, but I've also heard people say that actually Norway is relatively effective at lobbying Brussels. Even though officially it is a rule taker, it does still have some influence over what rules are made.
Well, in the same way that like a non-European country has influence over rules that are made, the Chinese will be lobbying the European Parliament as to the policies that they end up putting through. And who are they going to listen to more when it comes to lobbying? Probably China, if I'm being completely honest. I think it's a bad option. And this is kind of like, you know, when we first voted to leave, I said that either we need to, like, pretend like this never happened and stay, or we...
Although that's awful undemocrat at points, Jazza.
let's just pretend that last Thursday was just a big mistake. Like, it was a big bender. It was like the Hangover movies. Or we like cut everything, appreciate that we'll probably go into have huge financial and like social turmoil for a few years and then build ourselves up from the dystopian future that will inevitably wait for us.
I actually think the kind of language that Remainers, or some Remainers at least, have used, the kind of cliff edge thesis, the dystopia that is sometimes mentioned.
Mad Max, it's always Mad
Max.
Yeah,
Mad Max, that was actually a creation of David Davis, the Brexit secretary, if I'm not mistaken. But I think actually it's been unhelpful in the sense that it's not actually warded people off wanting Brexit to take place. It's merely entrenched the position and actually made Remainers less trustworthy, and has actually made them less effective in lobbying for the kind of soft Brexit that they really want. I know that criticism doesn't apply to all Remainers, but it definitely applies to some of them.
But then there is this balance, I think, of giving the electorate... And I almost feel kind of sorry for the politicians that are going through this at the moment. There's the balance of doing what the people want, which is leaving the European Union, but ensuring that the country doesn't fall to shit because of that. And there is a very fine line between those two things. And I think probably the EEA option, the European Economic Area option that Norway has, is probably the closest thing that you can get that will appease the leaving of the European Union for most people. Obviously, like, that's not going to keep David Davis happy, that's not going to keep Jacob Rees-Mogg happy, that's not going to keep Boris Johnson happy, but I think it will, like, okay, we left, but then also ensuring that we don't kind of flush everything down the shitter.
I mean, you're talking about everything, really. It's trade is the main thing, which is kind of important to bear in mind. Like, trade is obviously important, it's not the be-all and end-all of everything. But actually, I think I'm right in saying the EEA option does involve retaining free movement of people. Is that right? Or free movement of labour, which is slightly different.
Yeah, which is slightly different to people. People of labour and goods and services.
Right. The role that immigration played in the debate and the fact that it was listed as one of the main reasons for leaving, presumably that is politically not palatable to the majority of leavers.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Like, if immigration is really going to be the issue that the UK ends up kind of like hanging its colours to, then we just need to accept that we're going to be a less prosperous country. And I don't think that any politician is willing to be the person that leads the UK down that road.
I mean, it seems like getting back to the situation as it is, it does appear as though Theresa May is pursuing that, but without explicitly saying so, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
This is to kind of go back to my original question. I'm trying to follow along with the kind of terminology, the Max Fack thing that you mentioned, which is the sort of, as far as I understand, is the easing of border controls between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, making it as efficient as possible while still having them. All this different terminology I find kind of impenetrable, and I think I do tend to agree that the position from the British government is not really coherent, in the sense that it's I don't ultimately understand what they're trying to achieve, and a lot of what they say they're trying to achieve appears to be incompatible. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, I think so. And also, all of this kind of so this was one of the frustrating things, that piece of audio that was released by BuzzFeed of Boris Johnson talking to some Thatcherites, was the way that he talked about Northern Ireland as an issue worries me big time, because that country, that part of the UK, used to be a bloody war zone not very long ago at all. And it could very easily descend into that again.
See, the majority of views that I've heard is that it's not going to descend into a war zone again. That is actually
what makes
untrue.
You think that?
It just appears to be from reading the press that doesn't actually seem to be on the table at this point. You're right that, you know, the Good Friday Agreement was, what, 20 years ago now? Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ireland has changed since then. And I think it is. It's over-egging things to say that a new civil war or new terrorist insurgency is going to flare up over this.
But I think that it sets in motion the or pushes the ball down the hill that leads to Northern Ireland being sucked into the rest of Ireland again.
I
think that ends up being the only option.
Well, I mean, it sort of depends, really. I think it's difficult to make predictions about that kind of situation, because it could go in different ways, basically. I know that's a kind of flabby answer, but that's probably a more accurate answer than actually making, you know,
what are you
clear,
are you
clear
saying that there's nuance in the possibility of what's going to happen? Shocker.
Well, I think a lot of I'm sure I said this, I don't know if you agreed at the time, but when the Brexit vote was about to take place, there were a lot of fears about what it might mean for Scotland's position. If Britain were to vote to leave the EU, would Scotland then leave the UK and remain in the EU? And
yeah, and the appetite hasn't really been there.
No, it hasn't. And even the appetite for a second Scottish referendum
is through the floor.
Yeah, it hasn't. I mean, I think it's just generally declined over time. So what might appear logical when you sort of work it out yourself, as far as the, you know, various positions of Northern Ireland and Scotland. It does in some ways make sense. It did seem to make logical sense at the time to think that Scotland might look to, you know, get into the EU via the back door. But in practice, that doesn't appear to have happened. And even as you say, the public appetite for it doesn't appear to have been there. In the same way, had we voted Remain, in the short term, I think there would have been a lot of attempts not to sort of entertain a neverendum, i.e. rerunning the vote.
Neverendum.
It having been close.
Can we put a ban on new portmanteaus, please? Thank you.
We probably should.
Do you think that this would be any different with any other leader? If David Cameron had decided to actually stay, do you think that we'd be in a different kind of situation? Or do you think that Theresa May has just been... Do you think she's incompetent or unlucky?
I think she a bit of both, basically.
Can I be honest? I think she's doing her best to make a purse out of a pig's ear.
I think she was, you know, she took advantage of a situation that was not of her creation. She managed to play the leadership sort of election after Cameron left quite skillfully. But since then, the situation is difficult, and there's a lot that is essentially, to use that now very dull phrase about having cake and eating it, or, you know, eating cake and having it more properly. There doesn't appear like there's just a lack of honesty from the Tory government as to what needs to be traded off in order for the British people to get what they want. And I think to some degree that's actually reflected in what certain sections of the Leave vote
But so many of the people from the Leave vote actually don't give a shit about immigration. They believe in like a global Britain that actually should be taking in more people, but they've chained themselves to the anti-immigration rhetoric of people like Nigel Farage and the UK Independence Party, that
You're making a distinction between, say, the Tory Brexiteers, Boris Johnson is actually quite pro-migration when it comes down to it.
Even David Davis.
Yeah, and also your Daniel Hannans as well, who's the Tory MEP. There's like free trade Brexiteers who are generally pro-migration. But I mean, conversely...
But have known that in order to get what they want, in order to get the British people to vote to leave the European Union, which they saw as protectionist and all of those kind of things, they needed to make them hate foreigners. And you can't have this big, great...
Unfair.
No, I don't think that's unfair at all. I think that's pretty damn accurate.
No, I think what actually happened is that there has been long-standing scepticism about migration from the British public, and the Leave campaign recognised that that was the case and capitalised on it.
I think that's exactly what I said.
No, you have the lines of causality wrong. You think that they... you literally just said they caused the British people to hate migrants or like stoked it up. In fact,
I didn't mean cause.
The fire was already there. To sort of continue with that metaphor, it was something that was capitalised on, and I think actually that was probably Nigel Farage's key strategic insight, if you were, you know, want to put it in those terms. Is that
also Dacre at the Mail as well, though he's a man who also wants there to be a free trading, low regulation Britain that was able to, and he was able to plant distrust and hate of people from other countries through his papers.
I mean, I think I fundamentally disagree with... It is true that newspapers do influence what their readers think, but it is also true that people largely choose their newspapers based on their own pre-existing prejudices. So I think the lines of causality are not what you'd suggest there. Paul Dacre's just stepped down, actually, as the editor of the Daily Mail.
We're very excited on the Remain site, Jimmy, because it's being taken over by a Remain.
Yeah, Geordie Grieg from the Mail on Sunday, which is actually run as a separate editorial operation from the Daily Mail.
The Mail on Sunday was pro-Remain.
Remain. And actually, Lord Rothermere, who's the proprietor of both the Mail papers and Mail Online, is also pro-Remain himself. Is actually, you know, much more cosmopolitan in his outlook than you'd expect, given that he owns those papers.
Yeah. Shall we shuffle on to Lush?
Yeah, we probably should. We can, you know, have another Barney about Brexit later.
Have you ever shopped in Lush, Jimmy?
No.
Have you never wanted to sit in a soup of your own kind of like festering flesh and glitter so that you can't get out these shiny particles from your pubes for the next 2 weeks? Because that's exactly what happens when you shop at Lush.
Yeah. It sounds great. I take it you have shopped at Lush then in the past.
I have. I like them, but the places stink and their salespeople are like happy little elves that I just want to shut up. Hello, are you okay there? How about you try this, and this, and I'm like, I'm here for toothpaste.
It is a bit weird, as like, I have actually been into Lush, and some of the cosmetic products do look as though they should be food, which is kind of unsettling. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, no, 100%, everything in there looks edible.
Yeah, it does, which is probably a terrible idea.
Tell me what they've done, Jimmy.
So, I mean, I think you alluded to it in the introduction, but Lush has a history of being sort of right on, to use that kind of Rod Liddell phrase, being on the right side of history and campaigning for sugar, spice and everything nice.
Yeah.
And it decided to run this Spy Cops campaign. The Spy Cops were undercover police who formed romantic relationships with activists.
Were the romantic relationships deliberate? Or did they just kind of slip and fall into them?
Was that a deliberate allusion to rape?
No! Oh my god, no!
Jesus. I don't know, actually, if it was part of the plan or if it just kind of...
Just fell in love, you know?
Yeah, there is an inquiry sort of relating to this. We were just reading, doing some hasty cribbing just before we actually recorded the main segment, and it appears that some of the policemen were actually already married when they formed relationships as part of their undercover work. So yeah, anyway, they decided.
I mean, that is objectively fucked up. Why shouldn't Lush be able to campaign against that kind of stuff?
Because it's a soap shop.
Yeah, but they're an activist soap shop. They're like pro-vegan, anti-animal testing. They love a bit Greenpeace. All of that kind of stuff. It's very much part of their brand.
I guess so, but. I mean, I'm a little bit troubled by the enthusiasm for corporate dabbling in kind of social politics that has happened over the. I mean, it's far worse in America, where there's far more like toing and froing as to like. I mean, famously, the Silicon Valley companies are generally very pro, say, LGBT issues, and I don't have a problem.
And Chick-fil-A don't
are anti gay marriage.
I mean, they fund conversion therapy. Also, as a result, also pretty anti-gay marriage, but that's not the worst thing that they're against.
I just think it's... I'm sort of against it. I mean, I'd obviously take a view on those specific issues, but I think companies should be there to sell products and services. I think it's actually pretty unhealthy for politics as a whole when companies start saying, oh, we're pro this particular... you know, policy that has no real relation to their business.
What are you talking about? What world have you been living in? That's what we experience. We have companies not just lobbying behind the scenes, but actively campaigning for the world that they want to create, right?
I don't mind, like, companies are going to lobby for, like, tax breaks and regulations that suit their business models and all that kind of thing. And to a degree, I think that's legitimate, although lobbying can be pretty perverse and corrupt in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But when it sort of spills over to this kind of, like, social policy thing, I just think it's... I mean, a lot of the time it's kind of naff, which I guess is a aesthetic objection, but... I don't know, man. I don't think it's a good idea. I think, you know, if I go to Lush, I want to... I mean, I won't, but like, if I did go to Lush, I'd just want to buy soap. I don't want to be bothered by whatever.
But I think a lot of the people who do buy at Lush are okay with there being like a social justice element to their experience. I don't think that that's abnormal. What I will say, though, is when you look at the campaigns that they had up in windows and stuff, it looked like an anti-police campaign, and I think that that was the problem.
Yeah, it was. Like it was very ham-fisted, like it was, in execution. Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't look like it was a campaign against this very specific fucked up thing that the police decided to do. It looked like it was, undercover cops are bad. Hate them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly well-known case, but when I saw the like initial posters, and I was actually aware of the spy cops thing, it was hard to tell that they were targeting a specific activities of the police and not just the police in general. So, but then sort of looking at the campaign posters and that, I'm not really sure how they would have done it in another way. But yeah, I to get back to the previous point, yes, it is part of their brand, but at the same time, do we really want a situation where people have different shops based on their political preferences?
I mean, but that's what we have.
Do we have that? I mean, Sainsbury's, Tesco, Asda, and Morrison's are all apolitical organisations.
But anybody who is aware enough as a consumer does choose where they are going to end up buying their products and what companies they buy from based on their ethics.
Such as what?
Like, for example, a lot of people choose not to chose to boycott H&M. After they had that awkwardly racist shirt in an advert.
I mean, a handful of people you associate with might have done, but I think generally people ignore this sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I agree in general people do. But I think that Lush has that brand where the people who shop there do tend to be more socially conscious.
I mean, but from a strategy point of view, corporate strategy, it does...
Oh, are you consulting for them now, Jimmy?
I'm not consulting for them, but all that, like, I guess, like, if people are already that way inclined, all they've, I think, really done is alienated people who don't shop there, or maybe would occasionally shop there, and they've just, you know, girded the loins of the people who already shop there. So I'm not sure if that works very well as a strategy. It appears to sort of narrow their potential appeal rather than expand on it.
Yeah, I think that they also kind of have this like social good wing that is in charge of those kinds of things. So maybe they'll have a campaign about like I wouldn't feel like my commercial space when I decided to go into Lush was being invaded if they had like a campaign about saving the whales, for example, or if they had a campaign about recycling plastic, or they had a like any of those kinds of things. Those are all like similar kinds of things, and this is in that space. Because it directly because the Spike Ops worked around like Greenpeace activists and the like.
I can see
so for them it feels like the same space, but actually when you don't know an awful lot about the story, it looks like you're just doing an anti-police ad.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's taken place here. And, you know, the environmental stuff, given their stance on, say,
animal testing,
it does make... It's more intuitive, let's say. Mm-hmm. And probably I'd be less... I'd find that less obnoxious than I found the anti-Spike Ops thing. Even though I think Spike Ops are bad. That's the thing. I'm actually...
Yeah, this whole Spike Ops thing was...
You know, I'm on board with their general point. I'm just like... I'm just... What are you doing? What is this?
I'd be curious, because they said that they were doing it because they felt like the inquiry wasn't going particularly well, and I'd be curious for them to elaborate on that. Unfortunately, they're no longer doing their campaign. So. Mm.
I suppose here's a question for you. If you were had shares, I don't know if Lush is a public company, but say you had shares in a socially conscious company, and then they did something like this, would you be pissed off?
Well, Why if I had shares in it?
Because, the traditional view on shares is that shareholders want to make as high a return as possible, therefore they want the business to do as well as possible. And if the CEO is dicking around doing some weird social campaigning that doesn't have an obvious relevance to the bottom line, that's a bit questionable, isn't it?
Yeah, but if it increases the standing of Lush as a company that is social good and increases the amount of money that people are willing to go there because they know that they are supporting social good causes, that makes a lot of sense commercially, right?
Yeah, it can do. It depends on the...
I wouldn't invest in something like Lush if I didn't... if I wasn't okay with them occasionally doing stuff like this.
Yeah, that does make sense.
You know, I feel like you kind of know what you're buying.
Yeah, to some degree. So yeah, only invest in cynical companies that only want money.
Yeah, buy gold.
Buy gold.
Sell gold.
Buy or sell gold as a program. Yeah.
stick or twist.
Okay, shall we wrap this up then, Jazza? Where can they find you on Twitter and so on?
Oh, you can find me at Jazza John. That's spelt JAZZAJOHN across most social platforms.
Okay, and you can find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols. I don't think I'm on.
That's JDEN. No,
sorry. I'm not 100% sure you know how to spell my surname. So.
I'm occasionally slightly flummoxed as to how many L's are in it.
Yeah, and there's also an H, which really does not need to be there. So.
Yeah, but welcome to English, mate.
Welcome to English. All right. On that bombshell.
Oh, leave us a review.
Yep.
Love us. Prove it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.